Please be seated. The court is ready to hear argument in 040490 in re Palm Harbor Homes, Inc. and Palm Harbor Homes 1 LP.
May it please the court, Mr. Craig Patrick will present argument to the relators. The relators have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning, may it please the Honorable Supreme Court. In late 1998, the Ripples, the real parties in interest, purchased the manufactured home from the retailer, in this case, Palm Harbor Village. It was manufactured by the manufacturer, Palm Harbor Homes 1 LP, Palm Harbor Homes Inc. In connection with the purchase of the home, Palm Harbor Village and the Ripples signed two broad arbitration agreements and agreed that any disputes related to the home essentially would be submitted to binding arbitration. The second arbitration agreement, however, contained an opt-out provision wherein Palm Harbor Homes, a non-signatory to the contract and a third-party beneficiary under the contract, could elect to opt out of the arbitration proceeding.
I wasn't sure from the language of the clause of the opt-out clause whether they could wait till after the arbitration to opt out to see what the award was or not.
It almost my reading of it, Your Honor, is that our position is that this opt-out provision is a restriction on Palm Harbor Homes' rights. That Palm Harbor Homes was only able to opt out of the arbitration by giving written notice of the election to all parties within 20 days of receipt of the notice from another party. So once Palm Harbor Homes gets a notice from any party if they intend to go forward with an arbitration, Palm Harbor Homes only has 20 days to send written notice to the other party saying, we don't want to accept this benefit as third-party beneficiary. Now, it is our position that the trial court abuses discretion in refusing to enforce this arbitration agreement. And the focus of this mandamus action is on the Ripples' defenses to the arbitration agreement. I see four primary issues in this case, the first three of which I believe concerns solely the effect of this opt-out provision. And the last one seems to address the arbitration provision as an agreement as a whole. The first issue is whether there was any independent consideration given for the opt-out provision. The second issue is whether the opt-out provision rendered the entire or that portion of the arbitration agreement substantively unconscionable. And then the third issue, similar to what we heard earlier this morning, and that is whether Palm Harbor Homes, as a manufacturer non-signatory, in the event that the court were to find that it was the opt-out provision was substantively unconscionable or lacked in mutuality, whether Palm Harbor Homes could then still enforce its rights under the arbitration agreement as a non-signatory to the contract, and finally, whether the entire arbitration agreement entered into in a procedurally unconscionable fashion. Now, is the relator's position that the opt-out provision does not amount to lack of consideration because this was a mutually binding contract supported by consideration between Palm Harbor Village and the Ripples. And the agreement states that they specifically inured to the benefit of Palm Harbor Homes, the manufacturer, but allows Palm Harbor Homes a brief opportunity to decline the benefit. Now, as well-reasoned contract law provides that a third-party beneficiary can, prior to vesting, reject the offer or the benefit. And moreover, the third-party beneficiary who is not a party to the contract need not provide independent consideration. Because contracting parties cannot force a benefit on a non-signatory to the party. And the opt-out provision is merely restricting Palm Harbor Homes' right.
Noticed you relied on commentators mostly.
Yeah, this was an area of law that was difficult to find specific cases on. And it seems to be something that we can look at what is, I couldn't find a case to the contrary. And so we're looking at what seems to be commentary and what seems to be well-reasoned.
The whole term third-party beneficiary implies that it's people claiming, third parties claiming a benefit. We don't really have a third party obligee area of the law or something, but you weren't, other than these recent arbitration cases, you're unaware of any?
No, Your Honor. And that's our point, is that since this is a benefit, that it's the two parties to a contract can't force this benefit upon someone. And the case law says that, or the commentary states that until that right vests in Palm Harbor, and they do become Palm Harbor Homes, the manufacturer, it does become bound, that it has a right to reject that benefit. And that this particular clause is actually a limit on that right. It's saying you have to notify everyone in writing within 20 days or you're going to be bound. Essentially, it's an express vesting provided there in the contract. And basically, you know, the expressibility of a third-party beneficiary to disclaim this benefit should not destroy the underlying consideration between Palm Harbor Homes, Palm Harbor Village, the retailer, and the Ripples. And so at a minimum, what we have here, we have a valid...
Have any Texas cases on that? That seems to me that would be a rule of general application. Any Texas cases specifically by this court that each clause of the contract does not require independent consideration? That's what you're arguing, if I understand it correctly.
That's consistent with what the way that the Court of Appeals in this case considered it. They looked at the clause itself and saying that the clause did not have independent consideration.
And what's your authority for saying, well, the whole rest of the contract is independent consideration?
Well, I guess what I'm arguing is if the clause itself does not have independent consideration, that shouldn't destroy the entire contract between the retailer and the purchaser, who both signed a mutually binding contract. And for those reasons, we believe that the Court of Appeals was incorrect in its majority, as well as the dissenting opinion also, in finding that this particular opt-out provision rendered the contract void for lack of mutuality.
Does the opt-out provision matter if the Gregson test is met?
I honestly don't think it does. I guess the only time it would matter is if we got to the last part of the argument, and that is the procedural unconscionability as a whole. But when you're looking at the first two issues, the substantive unconscionability, and you're looking at the lack of consideration, those focus just on the opt-out provision. And under Gregson and some other state cases, which are not exactly following Gregson, but I believe are still applicable, that whether the opt-out provision is there or not, Palm Harbor Homes, the manufacturer, can compel arbitration. As to the substantive unconscionability argument in N. Ray First Merit Bank,
let me ask you there.
Yes.
This clause is governed by the FAA?
The clause is governed by the FAA as well as the Texas Arbitration Act.
My recollection is it says y'all chose it to be governed by the FAA.
Yes.
And
yes.
So to the extent of any conflict, the FAA would govern.
Right.
And yet in your section on substantive unconscionability, you cite only Texas cases. What's the federal law of unconscionability?
Well, I believe that on the substantive unconscionability, that state law applies.
Because?
Because
But Gregson doesn't apply state law. Gregson just applies federal law. Governed by the FAA. I'm wondering why this shouldn't be governed by federal law.
Obviously Gregson is not binding on this court, and Gregson is an example of...
If Gregson is not, but if the U.S. Supreme Court says the same thing, it certainly is, because that's federal arbitration, and it's preempts state law. We can't say Texas unconscionability law preempts the FAA.
Well, I think that the distinction is that we look at the Federal Arbitration Act to determine whether a valid arbitration clause exists and whether it comes within the scope of the arbitration. But whether there's an actual defense to the contract, that's state law.
Well, wouldn't unconscionability be for the arbitrators?
It can be. You held that in First Merit, that both substantive and procedural arbitrability, unconscionability, are arbitrable claims that could be submitted to the arbitrator. But in the in-rate first marriage claim, basically substantive unconscionability is a principle of preventing oppression and unfair surprise, and looks at the contract to determine if on its face it's so one-sided to be a fair or impressive. And we believe that the only basis for finding substantive unconscionability is to look at the opt-out provision itself.
Well, let me ask you this. If the manufacturer exercised the opt-out clause, let's say the purchaser wanted to compel arbitration. Palm Harbor, nobody on Palm Harbor's side wanted to arbitrate, but the Ripples here decided they wanted to compel arbitration, and the manufacturer sent notice to opt out. Don't you think that they could not opt out? I mean, don't you think that under Grigson they'd be forced to arbitrate?
Well, that's possible. I mean, it's kind of the converse of whether the party who is attempting to file claims could force a non-signatory to arbitrate its claims, which is the opposite of what we have here, where we have a non-signatory trying to force a signatory to arbitrate its claims.
But I guess what I'm getting at is, do you start by analyzing the opt-out provision, or do you start by looking at Grigson? Because it seems to me that under Grigson, the opt-out provision could be just unenforceable if the claims are inextricably intertwined and you're relying on the agreement for the duties that you're suing on, then the opt-out just wouldn't apply.
I don't believe that Grigson's second prong of the Grigson test basically says that when a signatory to a contract containing an arbitration clause raises allegations of substantially interdependent concerted misconduct by the non-signatory and one or more signatory, I thought in Grigson that basically we have what we have here, and that is a non-signatory.
I'm just trying to understand how it would work the other way. If you had a signatory trying to compel the non-signatory here, it doesn't seem to me like the opt-out right would be any good.
Well, that very well might be. If we were on that issue, if that had happened, I can't sit here. I haven't thought that through.
Well, I mean, if you've got an unenforceable opt-out provision, it strikes me as odd that you try to analyze whether an opt-out provision can make the agreement unconscionable if it turns out not to be enforceable in the first place.
I guess if we assume that it's unenforceable, then we just would step into the Grigson test and would argue that in fact we should still be allowed as Palm Harbor Homes to enforce the arbitration provision against the Ripples.
What claims were there that we needed Homes for? Are there any claims that were recoverable only against Homes as opposed to Village?
That really kind of, to me, takes more of a look at, I guess we look at the petition and we're going to move over to the Grigson analysis. I'd like to just point out that there is some Texas courts of appeals that have, one has followed Grigson, and another has kind of set up what appears to be its own standard, but to me they seem very similar. The Court of Appeals in In Re Education Management Corporation says that a party may be a stop from avoiding arbitration of claims against non-signatories if those claims and the claims against the signatory are based on the same operative facts or are inherently inseparable. And it seems to be that inherently inseparable is very similar to substantially interdependent and concerted misconduct. But what we have here is we have a petition that makes claims. There's three claims in the petition. They're all UCC breach of warranty claims. There's a breach of implied warranty and merchantability, a breach of failure to repair in a good and workmanlike manner, and there's a breach of express warranty. All of the claims are directed at both defendants and allege the exact conduct which breached all these warranties. So I'm not aware of any specific claim in this case that was made solely against one defendant or the other defendant. There weren't any alleged misrepresentations by the retailer that wouldn't apply to the manufacturer, and there weren't any claims against the manufacturer that they didn't try to make against the retailer as the seller. So we believe that under either the Grigson test or the case set forth in the NRA, the theory set forth in NRA Education Management, that because of the nature of the claims made by plaintiff, and also because of the fact that if you look at the arbitration agreement itself, it is very broad. and all of the claims against both the relators fit within the broad definition of claims related to the home. And for those reasons, we don't believe that even if the opt-out provision was rendered void, that the court should We don't believe that, the court it would be appropriate to find the whether the clause is present or not, that it has no impact on the outcome of the case, which would be to compel both the Ripples to compel both their claims against the manufacturer and the retailer of the home.
Thank you, Counselor. The court is ready to hear argument from the real party.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Mr. Doug Holden will present argument to the real party.
May it please the court. Forgive my legally feeble mind on this, but I've analyzed this thing much simpler. I began with the question, why would this be so important as to arouse this court's jurisdiction? I got to thinking, maybe it has something to do with...
Because if you put synopsis includes compel arbitration into Westlaw, you get 40 cases.
Yes, Your Honor.
So, you know how many of them are by this court? One, first merit. And so, that's our job, is to try to tell the other 14 courts of appeals. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. However, in further analyzing that, it becomes more simply not just the impact that arbitration or the lack thereof or the trial court's decision to grant arbitration or find that it's a valid clause or provision between the parties, but it comes simply down to the test of did the trial court abuse its discretion when it determined simply that a contract or an agreement did not exist.
And as I asked in the first case, what is the discretionary call here?
The facts that surround the situation as applied to the law.
If you're suing on the contract, though,
yes,
which then again, that's an eight corners question, legal construction, no discretion there, no fact finding to be done.
Understandably, other than the facts applied to that came about as to the actual agreements between the party or the actual settings of the agreement or the alleged agreement or the actual circumstances.
Well, the claim that the trial courts normally don't decide the question as to whether this whole contract was unconscionable or this whole contract was the signatures are forged. That's normally, if we see an arbitration agreement, normally we send defenses to the whole contract to the arbitrators, don't we?
Understandably, if, in fact, there is no question as to the facts surrounding the trial court's decision.
If there was no question, there'd be no reason, nothing to send to the arbitrators. I'm assuming there is a question. Somebody says, I signed a contract under duress, that's not my signature. They breached first. All of those questions that the contract is not enforceable. Not the arbitration clause specific. The whole contract is not enforceable. That's the kind of thing that the arbitrators are going to decide on the merits, isn't it?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. Unfortunately, in this case, for Palm Harbor, the fact is there's no record below as to the facts that the actual trial court heard.
When you say no record, we don't have the contracts in our record.
And let me rephrase, please, sir. I'm talking about a reporter's record as to the arguments that were made, the actual factual considerations that were opted in argument of counsel.
Did anybody testify?
The only testimony we have is in the form of affidavits by the Ripples, which clearly, I'm sorry.
So there's no, what would the, if we had had a reporter's record, it's always interesting for us to read what you all said at the trial court, but usually by the time it gets up here, it's a little more refined and it's a waste of time to read what you argued in the trial court. Is there anything a witness or somebody said in the trial court that's not in our record?
Outside the affidavits, there is not. However,
but we don't have the affidavits in our record.
Yes, sir, you do. In the second, I believe, the second response, or the response to defendant's second motion to compel arbitration in Judge Sylvester's court. The thing about it is that absent that record, the presumption is, we can sit in Monday morning quarterback this all we want to, the presumption is that whatever the trial court heard, whatever testimony is there, the presumption is it heard enough.
If there isn't, you're saying there wasn't any.
other than the forms of the affidavit.
There's no presumption. There are no facts that the trial court had.
Your Honor, with due respect, I believe that there's a presumption that somehow there were some facts that
you're telling us there weren't. If everybody agrees there weren't, then there weren't, and that there's no presumption.
Outside of the affidavits, yes, ma'am. Correct.
Let me ask you this. Let's say that we agree with you. The opt-out provision was unconscionable. And therefore, you throw out the arbitration agreement as to the manufacturer. Could you still seek to compel arbitration, or could you still compel arbitration against the manufacturer under Goodson?
I don't believe so.
Why not?
Because my understanding is if the underlying contract, which purportedly inures to the benefit of the manufacturer, is void for whatever reason, whether it be unconscionability, lack of consideration, or a failure to meeting of the minds, which all three were argued and are of record, if for whatever reason the underlying contract was void, then it logically follows that any benefits inuring to the manufacturer would also be voided.
How do you claim they breached the warranties in the contract if the contract's void?
Well, outside of what counsel for Paul Palmer said, I believe that inherently there are separate causes of action against the retailer versus the manufacturer. And even presuming...
What's the difference? What are you suing the manufacturer for that you're not suing the retailer for?
There are certain contractual obligations that the retailer has with regards to conducting actual repairs.
Yes, my question was, I understand there's things you're suing the retailer for that you're not suing the manufacturer. Other way around. Is there some reason we have to have the manufacturer here? Can't you get everything you want from the retailer?
Not under statute, Your Honor.
What? Under what?
The old RCLA, for example. UCC also breaches of warranty and reputability and things of that nature.
All of those things are against everybody upstream, right?
Those particular ones are, yes, sir.
I mean, they pass with the goods. So the question again is there anything that we have to have the manufacturer for? Or are they just in here to try to get around arbitration?
No, sir.
Well, I know that's what you're going to say. I want to know why.
The only thing I can point to is in my understanding of the statutes, provide that there are certain exclusive remedies against the manufacturer, in this case, under the old RCLA, that are not provided for against the retailer. And I know it's a general answer, but that's the best I can do, you know, as far as my reading is that there are exclusive remedies against the manufacturer versus that of the retailer. And presume for a minute if we do grant arbitration or say that it was error for the court not to grant the arbitration between retailer and the Ripples, later we say, for example, settle against the retailer and still have those outstanding claims against the manufacturer. Not only do we have two parties that did not, and just by the record alone, actively engage in the agreement to arbitrate, but you also questionably have a constitutional violation in tow, because now two separate parties, not parties to the contract, are suddenly tossed into this mandatory arbitration, as was questionably engaged in between the retailer and the Ripples. Going back to the presumptions that I believe are afforded to the trial court without any kind of record. In fact, Justice Vance's opinion says that in the absence of any kind of record below, or a complete record below, then mandamus cannot lie. Obviously, I believe that the burden of proof, or the burden to show that this was an error, not just an error, a clear abuse of discretion, lies on the party who wishes to question that particular area of the court.
So the specifications, the manufacturer specifications, didn't they appear in the retail contract? There weren't two contracts.
No, ma'am, but to answer the first question, the manufacturer specifications did appear in the entire bundle of the contract, if you will.
In the retail
sales contract.
So the duties that the Ripples are seeking to enforce against the manufacturer arise from the agreement in which the arbitration clause appears.
I don't necessarily find, I think that's a little oversimplification, because the contract, if you will, it seems that we're kind of blurring the distinction between the contract as a whole, meaning the purchase of the actual home, versus the snippets, if you will, of the agreement to actually purchase. I believe that this arbitration provision, both of them, the second one, of course, in our argument, overrules the first because of the opt-out provision. But I believe this arbitration agreement is and does stand alone, despite the fact of the consideration that it claims that it recites.
What if this were a contract between a lawyer and a client, and the agreement said that the client, at its option, can opt out of arbitration? Would that void the arbitration clause?
If that were recited as consideration, as one of the main components of consideration, I would argue that that would be invalid because it's illusory, because there's no obligation there. You have.
Well, there are other, the contract supported by other elements of consideration. The lawyer agrees to provide services, the client agrees to pay a fee, and then there's an arbitration clause that says if we get in any kind of dispute about this, the services provided or the fee agreement, we're going to arbitrate, except that the client has, at its option, has 20 days to opt out. Would that void the arbitration clause for?
Outside of, I apologize. Outside of the consideration argument I made, I believe that it would because it's unconscionable. I believe that it's patently unfair.
So anything in any contract that gives one of the parties an option in the future voids the whole contract? Or is that just an arbitration clause?
I think that again, is an oversimplification, an overgeneralization. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Right. These are all the time. I rent an apartment for a year. At my option to continue month to month thereafter at 125%. Because it's my option whether to extend beyond, the whole contract's void.
No, sir. I think
can't be.
No, sir.
So why does this rule? So this is a rule that only applies to arbitration clauses.
No, sir. I think it's fact specific. It has to do.
How is that different from saying it only applies to arbitration clauses?
No, sir. I would argue that that statement may be true if the facts dictate so. For example, the surrounding circumstances. We're talking about the bargaining power of the parties with regard to unconscionability. Are the facts that set this case apart? And would distinguish it and say, in this particular instance, because of what the affidavits say on the conditions and the circumstances surrounding the agreement.
So poor people can avoid. So poor people's contracts are illusory, but rich people's are not.
No, sir. I think it has.
What facts are you talking about?
In this particular instance, all the facts that are outlined in the affidavits, for example, the commercial ignorance of the witness, for example. The fact, in light of the recent Prudential case, there was not a knowing, voluntary, and intelligent waiver of their jury trial. The other circumstances as to you have a manufacturer who is conducts these commercial type.
Well, I mean, let's not beat around the bush. Rich people don't normally buy mobile homes, manufactured homes. These are not going to be our most sophisticated, most highly educated consumers. Are we, in effect, saying you can't sell manufactured homes in Texas because people that tend to buy those will be able to get out of the contract because they're not as highly educated or whatever?
I would believe that that'd be an unfair generalization, Your Honor. I believe that.
How do we accept your argument that this was unconscionable here without, in fact, telling all manufacturers of manufactured homes you sell manufactured homes in Texas at your own risk?
No, sir. I believe that you can get around that dilemma by saying if the facts that the trial court is presumed to have heard, which aren't evident here, if the facts dictate that either the contract failed for lack of consideration, for unconscionability, or just for generally a want of the meeting of the minds, then factually you can distinguish that if this particular waiver of a jury trial, I know I do that kind of analogously, but if those waivers and if these things that you're bargaining for, whether it be arbitration or any contract, if those things are not bargained for and there are facts of record that the trial court has presumed to have heard, then yes, sir, you can avoid that contract, especially in arbitration.
Let me hear your argument about the documents being ambiguous. You make an argument in your brief on page 8, page 9, and on page 10. These two documents are ambiguous, and therefore the mandamus shouldn't issue.
And I tie this into the intent or showing the intent of the parties, because on one hand, in the first bundle of documents that the Ripples signed, you have a general arbitration agreement that does not include any kind of opt-out provision. Yet, on relator's petition, they argue that these were all bargained for type agreements, et cetera, et cetera. However, a few months down the road, we get another set of documents that contains this opt-out provision. So, inherently, just by taking two provisions that supposedly apply to the entire contract in and of itself, just the mere fact that two of them exist with mutually exclusive terms and very material exclusive terms, that provides an ambiguity as to the intent of the parties.
Therefore, they lose. Right. Is that your position?
That's one of the arguments that was fielded by the trial court. And the presumptions afforded to it is that that is some reason, that is some evidence that he goes to show where either it fails for lack of consideration or the contract is just voided in general. I'm basically resting my laurels on the presumptions that go to the trial court. I realize that that may be an oversimplification, but because there's no record of below...
But you agree that the only facts in the record are the affidavits. There's no dispute about that.
That is correct as far as testimonial facts that are recorded. Yes,
what other evidence was there other than the affidavits and the documents?
No evidence, but according to case law, the trial court can review all of these proceedings with argument of counsel.
That's not evidence.
I understand that, Your Honor. But they may summarily review, and it's presumed because of the summary review of petition, because of arguments and things of that nature, because they're able to summarily review that, they're presumed to have heard enough facts or enough evidence or presumed to have found some evidence of record to justify its position. Notwithstanding any of that response, the fact is that there is some evidence of unconscionability at the very minimum in the Ripples affidavits. That's a particular substance that the trial court could have made its decision. And as far as I'm concerned, and again, it may be oversimplistic, but that's as far as this court needs to go. The fact that there is some evidence of record that goes to show that the trial court could have made the decision that it did. And just because this court may have decided another way doesn't necessarily mean that it may be overturned. And with that, again, I appreciate your time, and I'll rest on the laurels.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Can I
approach? Yes. May it please the court. I want just to close my argument by discussing the procedural unconscionability argument that was made by opposing counsel for the reason that this was the Court of Appeals in the underlying majority opinion did find that the arbitration agreement was procedurally unconscionable or essentially that the trial court had enough evidence to support that. Because we believe that when you look at the only evidence, and Justice Owen is correct, and that the only record are the documents that were before the court, the pleadings, and the affidavits, which were two identical affidavits provided by the Ripples in support of their defenses.
What about the ambiguity argument?
Well, actually, I believe that there's no ambiguity just because there's two documents. In fact, I think that the fact that there are two documents helps defeat their argument that they didn't understand what they were doing because they had two bites of the apple to read the contract.
Well, one says that the manufacturer has to arbitrate, and the other says the manufacturer gets bopped out.
Well, if the second, my opinion is that we would concede that the second one, when there is any kind, I believe the Court of Appeals addressed that issue and found that the second argument is controlling because it adds a new term to the contract. I don't believe that renders them unambiguous on their face.
If it had been Village that had the opt-out right, then it would be illusory.
I believe so.
Do you concede there is unequal bargaining power?
No, I don't.
And why not?
Well, that is the procedural unconscionability question. And the courts, especially in the employer-employee relationships, have held that the fact that you have a giant company that's an employer and an employee, that that's not unfair bargaining power. And certainly we can't hold that every consumer who buys an automobile...
So what is unequal bargaining power? When does it?
I don't have any specific examples in mind right now. But in this particular case, the only arguments that they put forth in their affidavits were that they were unsophisticated, it was their first transaction, that they were told it was a necessary document, that they weren't explained, that they were unaware of what arbitration was, and that they would not have signed it if they fully understood what they were signing. And if you look right above the signature line, in plain bold print, it says the parties knowingly waived any right to a jury trial. But they didn't read any of the entire document other than the big bold print line and all caps right above the signature line. They should have at least understood this means I don't get to try my case.
Let me ask you this. You said that if the opt-out provision had inured to the benefit of the retailer, the arbitration clause would have been illusory.
No, I think what I said was that if the retailer, as a contracting party, had an opt-out right, that would be illusory. And I believe...
I thought that's what I said, but if I didn't...
Halliburton.
Right. If it's illusory, then why is it not illusory as to the manufacturer, since the manufacturer is a third-party beneficiary, steps into the shoes of the retailer?
Well, you only step into the shoes once you vest. And I think that a third-party beneficiary, once its rights vest and it does step into the shoes, then there is no more opt-out provision, because it's already vested, and they have to step in the shoes and comply with the terms of the agreement.
In other words, A and B can't agree that C will do the following thing. C can always disclaim. But C can't accept it for a while and then decide to opt out.
Correct. And in this case, if Palm Harbor waits 21 days, then they're bound by it because their opt-out provision has expired on its own terms. And I think that it's well established in the courts that one who signs a contract is presumed to know its contents, that the agreements explain what the process is, that it clearly states that they waive their right to a jury trial, and because the cases have held that these types of arguments which have been made in the past do not arise in procedural unconscionability, we believe that the court erred and abused its discretion in finding that the parties should not be compelled to arbitration. For that reason, we request that the court issue a mandate to the trial court to correct it there. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The court will take a brief recess.